Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch. Episode 131 for August 18th, 2010. Beata. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com. I've been doing all sorts of open source software for many, many years, making my living off of it for most of the time. And so I love doing this show because I get to talk to some really cool people about open source projects, products, ways that open source gets to help people and use people, not use people, way people get to use open source software. And as you might hear in the background, that I have a co-host this week again. You've seen him here before. You've heard him here before. It's my good friend Dan Lynch. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks very much. I apologize for laughing in the background.
Well, you know, it's not like I actually rehearse any of this. You know, anybody's watching the live stream will know that this is completely off the cuff as I often do it. And in fact, speaking of the live stream, if you want to watch us tape this show, you can come to live.twit.tv anytime. Well, when we're taping, it's not just any time, at 9:30 on Wednesday mornings, typically. We occasionally have to drop a show out, but 9:30 Wednesday mornings, Pacific time, which is 12:30 East Coast time. And what is it in the UK right now?
It's 5:30 in the evening.
Okay, 5:30. So there's the times for you. You can come watch us and chat with us. We have a live chat room that you can ask questions like we're going to have today as we're chatting with our guest. The chat room will let us probably give us a few questions to ask our guests. In fact, let me go ahead and find my notes here about our guest. This week we have Stephen Heminger. Stephen works for the Viata company. Viata is also the name of the software, the open source software we're going to talk about today. Viata is I'm thinking it's sort of like a Cisco clone, which is Cisco is a big routers company, and they make probably most of the hardware for most of the backbone of the net. So routers provide ways for your packets to get from here to there. It's got a typical connection will involve 10 or 15 routers to get from one end to the other. And so what Viata is there's an open source software component that you can download and use wherever you want. There's a commercial version of it that has a few more features, and then they also sell hardware, so it's to bring it all together. So we're going to talk about all those different solutions, I'm sure, and talk about the history of the company and all that sort of stuff. That's typically what we do in the show, so I might as well get started. Any opening words before we get going, Dan?
Now, let's do it. Let's go for it.
So let's go ahead and bring our guest on the line, Stephen Heminger, calling to us from where? Where are you speaking to us from, Stephen?
Beaverton, Oregon.
Beaverton, Oregon, you're just down the road from me? We could just be doing this in the same room and we're using this complex Skype technology?
Yeah, well, we probably pass as ships on the night in Starbucks.
It is pretty odd. I wonder if you're like within a mile of me, because I'm actually in my home in Aloha, Oregon right now. But both of our calls are going down to Petaluma, California to be mixed together and sent back. That's pretty amazing. So enough about home square stuff. Let's go ahead and, I gave a sort of a brief description of what Viata is in the opening of the show, but I'm sure I didn't do it justice. So can you give me first like the 30-second pitch and then we can expand from there?
Sure. Viata is an open source router based on Linux. It started out with a bunch of developers before my time were in a networking startup and decided to build a product on top of something. And they said, well, we can use Linux to provide a routing solution. And well, what are the two problems? Well, it was missing a distribution that had support for that as a regular support. It was also missing a user interface that was familiar to router customers. So a lot of what Viata has done is build a CLI, not a GUI. I mean, we have a GUI, but main thing people use is the CLI that looks like Cisco or Juniper to be familiar with router customers.
Well, let's back up just a little bit further. So why would I need a router?
Well, you need a router to get your bits across the internet. Most people don't realize that their bits just don't magically show up at the other end.
Well, they actually do for most of us. So what you're saying, though, is that behind the scenes there's more going on.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on. All your packets get well, they also end up getting mangled and redistributed and controlled. But basically, it's all about control and data movement. And
okay,
there's little ones you have in your home, which you probably get from your cable company or something, and there's bigger ones as you go back up the backbone to larger companies and bigger infrastructure providers.
So part of the function of a router is to provide a way for me to for the bits to know where to go. I mean, because I'm obviously sitting here. Yeah, I'm sitting here in Beaverton or Lowell, Oregon, and somehow all the traffic that's going out for this show has to get to Petaluma, California somehow. So each router knows generally what upstream is towards the bigger part of the internet, but at some point it's got to get out from the big part of the internet back down to where it actually needs to end up, and that's
thing like your post office, where you know your mail always pretty much goes through the same route. I'm assuming that's how the post office works. And the internet, things change, companies come on and offline, lightning storms happen, and data gets rerouted all the time.
Okay, and these routers have protocols that they all talk back and forth to each other to kind of figure out where upstream is and where downstream is and how to get to, say, my home network and stuff then, right?
Yeah, and it gets a lot more complicated because there's all sorts of business rules about we have peering relations with another company and we agree to send certain percentage of the flow or certain traffic to certain places over those channels. So it's not always the closest path. It may be the best business decision path that goes on.
Cool. And the other big function of a router, at least the way I see routers, and maybe you can tell me there's a third or fourth function, but another big function that a router does is it's also typically your firewall. It's typically the thing that decides whether packets are actually allowed to be transferred from one side of the network to another. Like my home network doesn't let anybody in to my IPv4 addresses because that's just the way the rules are.
Yeah. Most routers have rules about what traffic they will allow through based on addresses and ports and even content, higher level content. And different businesses have different rules, and you may want one thing at home and you may want your ISP to have something different. Your ISP may have rules to say, well, I don't want to let mailbots go flood the network with spam, so I'm not going to let data on port 25, which is the SMTP outgoing mail port, to come in.
Mm-hmm. So the space for routers has traditionally been hardware. So I would buy a hardware router from Cisco or Linksys or maybe Apple Airport or something like that in order to provide my router. But Viata is actually a number of different pieces, right? There's the software part, there's the hardware part. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, we have two sets of software. There's a community version, the open source, download the ISO. I recommend everybody go do it. We have a stable and a beta version right now. And supported versions for commercial customers that have a few more features. Plus, we OEM hardware, both small boxes and larger boxes, which are actually Dell machines, to be used on backbones and corporations.
Okay, so there is a...
I should also add a third thing, which is we have VMware and Zen instances as well. A lot of people are using our software as virtual machines in virtual environments to provide virtual router functionality.
Well, let's start with the thing that probably most of my audience is interested in, which is the community edition, the open source edition. So I would take out like a commodity hardware box that had the right interfaces for it, right? Like maybe a couple of network cards, maybe a wireless card or something. And then I would just download this and run it. Is it run on the bare metal, or do I need to have an operating system underneath it, or what?
It comes as a CD image, and so you burn the CD image and you boot off the CD. And from there, you can go look online at the documentation, but you can actually run off the CD image, play around with it, or you can install that CD image onto a hard drive or even a flash card.
Cool. So I don't need to have like a box already running Linux that this sits on top of. It's not software that I'm installing. It's actually a whole OS all the way down to the base.
Our software is really a Debian under the covers. So we start out with a small subset of Debian packages, and we fix some and we add some of our own to create a full distribution.
So, Steve, you mentioned that you're based on Linux. What made you choose Linux as a base for the project? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, Viata, small startup company. What do we look for? The most developers, the biggest project that's out there, and the most advanced. And really what we're after is the bigger size customers with the bigger needs, and Linux has the broadest networking around. So everything from bonding to wireless to all the more advanced packet filtering services you can all get on Linux. I'm not really picking on the BSD guys. They make a lot of sense for the smaller embedded or even home router space. And I'll be honest that Linksys and some of the other companies use BSD as their internal backbone for a lot of their smaller products.
Now, you said it's based on Debian Linux. Is that right?
Yes.
We did that. Why did you go for Debian then?
Because we wanted to provide, we want something that was modular. So we want to only provide a few packages. We don't want to have to build the whole thing from scratch. So we have a few packages. Most of them are actually updates to existing packages. For example, Quagga, which is the routing daemon suite, and it has BGP and RIP and OSPF and all the fancy routing protocols everybody wants. And we participate on that upstream team, and so we want to provide the latest version. So, for example, fixing IPv6 bugs, which is what I've been doing the last 3 days.
Yeah, very cool. So what's the difference between, say, the commercial version and the community version then? Do you need a special kind of distribution? Do you need, like, a Red Hat Enterprise Linux or something to run the commercial version?
The commercial version has a few more packages, and some of those packages deal with ADSL and serial hardware, special purpose hardware that people often use, and they also provide some, they provide some packages that have upstream provider licenses that aren't open source. They also have a few components that we developed that we don't really ready to open source yet for a login. But they're all features that really are more targeted outside the domain of the community user. I really hate to do the open core thing, but we wanted to have some value-added features.
Yeah, I mean, how many users do you have? Do you know what kind of user base you've got? It's always hard to tell with these open source projects because you haven't got a necessarily receipt for every download, certainly on the free versions.
We actually do keep count of the downloads, and we have every time it rolls over a major number, there's a big party back in the office in California. And I believe the current number was over 500,000.
Wow.
And we also have a way of tracking it's how many people actually get it up and running, because when you boot it, the default install sets the NTP server back to one that we have in the home office, so we can keep track of how many people have booted up and called home. It's not really meant as a major security thing. It's just a way for us to keep track of how many people installed the software.
Mm. And is there any way to know what the kind of split is between people who are running this on their own hardware and people who've got your dedicated OEM hardware running the same thing?
I'm not in marketing, so I don't have the split. What I really find is that there's a large number, more people that take the community version, download it, try it out, and then there's a smaller core set of people that are either subscription or actually using it in their business.
That's cool. Randall mentioned getting an old beige box with a networking card and stuff like that. Is it really that simple though? Do you need, what kind of hardware requirements have you got for installing it?
Basically, we've got to the point where anything like modern generation Pentium and beyond works. But obviously, better hardware gives you better performance and less trouble. I mean, I always rue the day that somebody will pull out an old 3C501 card and then run a performance test on an old P3 box and then say, hey, this is terrible. The performance doesn't match whatever their marketing numbers. And, of course, our marketing and our engineering people are running on latest Intel, you know, Westmere and Nehalem boxes and getting 10 gig throughput, and the poor guy on his beige box isn't going to get anywhere near that.
No, that makes sense. So one thing I was curious about is it's a strange name, Viata. So where does it come from? I think Randall had some thoughts on this as well.
Does anybody want the real answer, or do you want to play guess?
I'm not really good at guessing, but I am curious where the name came from.
The marketing people, when they started the company, like any time you've got to make up a company name, they start doing Google searches to find out a name, and they discovered the Sanskrit word for open was Vyata. Ah. So they said, oh, this would be a cool name. And then they made up the logo with this the V, and it looks kind of Sanskrit and cool. So
nice, wow. Nice. Yeah. Of course, that's sort of weird because, you know, the word is open, but really it's about closing down with firewalls and stuff. But okay.
It's like open BSD. It's really secure. That's why they call it open BSD.
Exactly.
Because they're so confident.
Hey, so could I, just talking about what you could install this on, I know that I have one of the old Linksys routers over here that has the Linux firmware essentially on it. Could you use Vyata as a firmware there for this, or does it require much more hardware support than is in the distribution?
The problem you're going to run into on the Linksys box is it isn't x86 hardware, and this is an x86 platform. So you're going to have, you could, if you're really skilled and you wanted to build it all from the source, and we'd give you instructions to build it from source, you could go figure out how to build it from source and have fun, but I think you'd have a lot of trouble.
Do you know anybody that's doing that or has done that?
I started to play around with it, but the build environment is really painful to have to go set up a MIPS build environment in a VM, and was really slow. So it's like my time is more valuable than to spend solving a build problem for that. And we're actually not targeting it that. We really want to go for the, you know, routing as a platform and routing as an infrastructure, not routing for small embedded boxes.
Yeah. Okay. So, speaking of that, what's your history? How did this come about, and what problem were you trying to solve at the time?
Me, history is I actually started out back at Sequent when they were doing SMP boxes over here in Beaverton. That was probably my main big time at Unix. And so, as they started to get bigger and went around, I went off and did some video server and database, and ended up in a .com startup. Doing, of all things, DRM, which is odd for a future open source person. And then they went bust, or closed their Portland office and imploded. And some people I knew from Sequent were at Open Source Development Lab over here in Beaverton. And they were hiring developers and getting involved. And so my first real start in open source was at OSDL. And as they merged and became Linux Foundation, I went looking around, and I had run into some people from Vyata at various conferences, and it seemed like a really cool idea. So I joined the team.
Now I'm wondering, you probably joined Sequent after I left. I was employee 64 there and worked about 2.5 years there before I went on to start Stonehenge 27 years ago. I wonder if that'd be weird if we both worked at Sequent at the same time too. This would be like really like old home week for me. Very strange. So what brought you? So you joined Vyata after it was already in place. So you weren't right at the beginning then?
Yes, that's correct. I guess I didn't get my founder shares, but yes, they had actually gone through a first couple of versions, and the first versions were on a different routing platform. It was Linux-based, but it was one of those ones where it was capable but wasn't expandable. It was written all in C++ and really wouldn't provide a generic scriptable platform. So I'm actually on the second generation, maybe even the third generation. I haven't been around long enough at Vyata, a product.
Was it always open source from the beginning, or did that decision come later?
It was always open source from the beginning. In fact, the first versions, I think they got more traction on the community version before they actually started to sell subscriptions.
Cool. That's great that a company would sort of decide that. How long has this been around?
Well, the current version's been around about 3 or 4 years, and I think the older version's probably going back another 3 or 4 years after that.
Definitely solving problems as they were arising. I know the internet kept growing quickly, and especially in the late 90s, that was definitely, well, it wouldn't quite be there, but like early 2003 then. But that's cool. I actually have a couple questions from the chat room. We do a chat room live while we're taping the show, and you can join us. I'll give you the instructions at the end of the show. Somebody asked, what inspired the command line interface?
If you've ever used Cisco, which is the 80% of the market provider, they have lots and lots of command line interface and lots of of training and technology behind that. So the users in the commercial router world are very familiar with command line interfaces. In fact, are very familiar with the actual syntax of the command line. So providing an interface that looks mostly the same, for the same reason that desktop users like a Windows-like interface. They grew up using it. So we wanted to provide a CLI that looks like what router operators expect.
And so typically if I have already some existing Cisco gear and I want to either expand or I just want to replace my aging Cisco gear, I could take this and sort of drop it in, so my operators wouldn't have to be retrained and I wouldn't have to change my APIs, or is there a lot of differences here that you have to, they're necessarily required?
Well, I'll use the example. When I was at OSDL, we had a receptionist, and the receptionist was using Windows. And for the longest time, she was using Windows. And I think the expectation was that's all she was able to use. And then after a few years, they said, well, why don't we give her a Linux desktop? And after about a couple of weeks, she was perfectly comfortable with the Linux desktop, and she was able to do her job. The same thing is true with this for an existing router person. The first couple of weeks, they may say, this is different. Because there's small syntax difference, little semantic differences, it's going to be hard for them. But once they get over the transition, they'll be able to make it. This is a familiar situation in this world, though. I mean, Juniper has the same kind of CLI as Cisco, but the actual syntax is different, and one has this kind of flavor, and one has this other's different semantics. So it's really a pretty standard thing.
I was reading through the history a little bit earlier, and I saw that originally you had sort of you got into some sort of a Viata shell that had a different set of commands, more like a Cisco iOS commands. But then you also had a separate environment for typing, you know, standard Linux commands, LS and things like that. But in recent releases, you've merged those, so you can type all that in the same interface?
Yeah, the first versions were based on Zorp, which is a giant C++ routing package, and you basically went into a different mode to talk of that. And what we did in the later releases is extend bash, so it has the same syntax, the same, you're in the same mode to type both Viata and regular commands. So you're really typing it bash, and just like if you're familiar with bash or shell, you have aliases and functions. The Viata components look the same way. They just go off to some scripting.
Cool. And that makes it easier for someone who's trying to administer this to not have to think about two different modes then.
And it's also really useful for a lot of our community users because they can put extensions on to have it talk to some other routing environment we never even thought of. And they can, since it's all script-based, they can say, I want to be able to set up this other bit of hardware or software, and they can put extensions on to do that.
Oh, so I could actually write like a bash script that had these iOS-like commands in them and run all that?
Yeah, basically when you say set interfaces, foo, whatever, it goes down to a file and it says, oh, there's a tag that says create. And when I get a create, go run this shell command or Perl. A lot of our stuff ends up being templates running Perl, and then the Perl goes and does the real work.
Ooh, Perl. I kind of like that for some reason. I wonder why. Great. Cool. We had pfSense on the show, I think, about a year and a half ago. Well, how would you contrast this with something sort of in the similar space like pfSense and OpenWRT and things like that? How would you contrast what Viata offers you to those software?
We try to go broader and bigger. They're very much targeting at the lower embedded kind of space. So we have the similar functionality. I wouldn't say it's all the same, and they probably have some feature that we don't, but we try to go and have more features and more breadth. We don't even have support for all the features that Linux networking has right now. I mean, Linux networking is huge. There's netfilter rules to do everything like classify packets based on the CPU usage of the router right now and things like that. And we run into situations where we're providing basically a layering and a syntax on top of these things, and we are manpower, time situations, and even just complexity. We don't want it to balloon up beyond what people could deal with.
Wow, cool. So there is a difference in scale, but I could use this for something small. It's not like I have to have a complex situation to even think about using Viata then.
No, but I just try to compare it with the guys who are targeting the smaller end of the scale and giving it choice to people. So also a lot of the smaller guys target at making it really user friendly on the GUI, and we haven't done that. It's kind of a little harder when the things get more complicated. And I look at my FiOS box, and it's running Linux, and it's got routing, and it's running a proprietary GUI that basically I can go in and add network nodes and configure DHCP and do things, or I can do nothing. I'm just a customer. So
That kind of leads into something I was interested about. You mentioned briefly that some of your customers have done cool things that you hadn't expected with Viata. So how easy is it to extend and you know, incorporate into other projects maybe, or you know, build on?
Well, it's how much work do you want to do and how big is your job? It's really not that hard. The command line is mapped to a directory hierarchy, and the directory hierarchy, you can add new directories for new tags, and you can add new values. And given those values, then you run your shell infrastructure to configure your new components. We've gotten even some new submissions from people. The other thing we do is we basically have a unified config file that gets parsed and then expanded out to a directory with values. So a lot of the Perl interface is to be able to query the configuration, find out the current values. We also have a transaction-based configuration. So you go into the configuration mode and you can configure a number of settings, and then you can decide, well, first of all, your configuration steps can validate that before you apply it. And then you can also say, oh, well, I didn't really mean to totally screw up my wireless. I'll discard it, and you can discard it, and it rolls back.
That's cool. So you don't need to be a Perl guru like Randall to get on with this thing?
No, really. In fact, a lot of our Perl is pretty straightforward. I guess a Perl wizard would look at it and laugh and say, oh, I can do that in two lines.
I've done that before. I tell you that some of the code that I've seen out there is just horrendous. And I've now started dialing down my expectations for what I think good Perl code needs to look like. nothing is exceeding my 30% threshold. So I figure I'll just move the median up to 60 now. So most of that code is awful back there.
You've lowered the bar.
Yeah. Then most code actually looks good by comparison. So it's not too bad. Hey, I'm also interested in, actually this came from the chat room. I don't know what this is, but what is, nope, never mind. I lost it. Sorry, scroll up.
Can I interject one thing? If anybody's really interested in configuring this stuff, back about a year and a half ago at Linux Congress in Germany, I gave a paper that's still available online on how to extend it. It's probably not up to date on syntax like any documentation. It gets behind in versions, but it's really a pretty good place if somebody was really into playing around with how do the internals and how the extensions work.
Cool. So I want to talk a second about the organization structure. So how many people are, I would say, well, I guess employed full-time or at least part-time, actually working for the company on the product?
I was actually looking at that. It's about 30, maybe a few more. We may have hit 40 people by now. And we have, I was counting, 8 people in engineering and 5 or 6 in QA. So we spent a lot of resources on QAing the product, because as you get more complicated and many more options, we invest more in upfront QA than to having to deal with back-end customer problems. And we have about 5 or 6 people in support as well.
Cool. And so this is primarily just from the professional, the commercial edition of the software, but also the hardware that you sell. So you manufacture the hardware, or you just OEM that and put the software on it?
We OEM it and do a lot of qualifications. So we have to do the whole, all the qualifications if it were a regular product, including software, hardware, et cetera. But we basically take hardware from Dell at this point.
Now, how does the community edition link forward and backward to the commercial edition? Is it like the Fedora Red Hat model, or how do you have that structured?
Actually, we've changed it over the last year. Before, we used to do, let's put the subscription out with the new features and have the community version be less often. Didn't really work as well as we hoped, so we switched over to say, we'll release both at the same time and test them at QA them at the same time, and the subscription edition will just have slightly less features.
Now, does that mean that you aren't actually, I mean, suppose somebody in the community, I mean, who has commit bits then? Is it only the company that has commit bits to the open version?
At this point, it's only the company, but we're trying. We have a small active user base, I would say, that actually submits things. So I think we've taken about 10 things in for each release. So it hasn't been a really blocking overhead. I think eventually, if it grows bigger and we have more users and more kind of off-the-wall things, we may have to deal with that a little more.
Why do you think you haven't gotten very many contributions? Is the code complex, or is there people just wanting to use it and it works so well, so there's no reason for contributions? Or what do you attribute that to?
Well, I attribute it to the fact that who our customers are network users. They are so there are sysadmins and maybe server developers. They aren't Linux developers down in the dirty. The concept of detailed Perl and C code may be something that scares them off. But there are still a lot of people that have the skills that overlap, but it's just the real core group are people that are know more about routing protocols and VLANs and all those things than they do about Perl.
So now that then sort of begs the question, are there ISVs that are taking this and putting their own layering on it, adding new things to the community edition, or is the really all the only reason you've open sourced this is to say we're open source, because there's not really a lot of flow back and forth?
In fact, that's kind of one of my worries, is we have a fair number of VARs and people that are selling in verticals and other segments, and they're either using the commercial bit version or part of the subscription version, and we may never actually see their contributions back. So I guess that always happens to everything. You put it out there, and you'd be happy if you get some 20-30% of the value back from your customers.
Yeah, I know it's going to be a problem for people like the Firefox and those other things that have really high level of consumers, but not very many programmers necessarily that are working on it. I'm sure you're facing a similar issue.
Yeah, that is a real problem. I just am most happy that people send back their problem reports so that someone can work on it. So it's more important to me that somebody complains to me that, VLANs and IPv6 doesn't work, and they tell it to us before it shows up at somebody who's really critical.
Yeah, we mentioned briefly before about the whole open core kind of model. It's something that's quite controversial at the moment, and I know there's been a lot of discussions and stuff. Is that something that causes you any apprehension, the whole being cast as open core? Would you say that you were, or do you think that's an unfair thing to say?
I'm actually kind of a little concerned, but I'm also not sure what's good open core and what's bad open core. I think that I know there's people that are very upset, like SugarCRM and so on, where you can only take it and you can only do it with their branding. I think that we're really providing a lot of value back to the community, and that's really what we're trying to do. Most of what I do ends up being in the upstream kernel or the Quagga stuff and shows up in everywhere.
Yeah, that's cool. So one thing that I was quite curious about was earlier this year, there was a lot of controversy in the Linux kernel community over Microsoft making their first contributions to the Linux kernel. And I think it came as a shock to a lot of people. But you actually had some kind of personal involvement in that, didn't you? So can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yeah, it started out with a lot of our users are using Viata in virtual environments as a virtual router. And so they put it in as a separate VM, and they route packets to it, and they run the routing protocols in that VM. And then we started out with VMware, and like I said, we've been doing Xen, and Hyper-V is Microsoft's virtual environment. It actually showed up on our community forum. I should also mention, if they go to the website, in Viata.org, there's a very active forum that provides a lot of support. And one of the users said, I'd like to run Viata on Hyper-V. And I said, oh, that looks cool. And I said, oh, what are the Hyper-V drivers? Did a few Google searches and found it, downloaded it, extracted it, and discovered there was a large binary component buried in the Hyper-V drivers they were providing. And obviously, we can't distribute that. It wasn't really something I could recommend to anybody. I won't go into whether it's legal or not. And I kicked around through some people. One of the main Linux maintainers is also here in Beaverton, and actually he's moved now, but he works for Novell, and Novell had some deals back with Microsoft. So I said, can you get this straightened out? And so I sent it away and provided some more information. And 6 months later, they open sourced it. It also helps that my ex-manager at OSDL is the director of the open source labs up there. So I've kept in touch with him. And we actually still haven't gotten the Hyper-V driver support into Viata. I was hoping to get to this release, but the drivers for Microsoft, they've done a good job, but they're still working out all the bugs and the details. And so we probably won't see them in the actual product till the next release.
Mm. And do you have any idea what the status is like with it getting into the Linux kernel? Because I know after all the initial controversy about Microsoft committing code under the GPL, there was then, I think it was Greg KH came out and said that they hadn't actually done anything with it for months, and he was thinking of removing it from the kernel staging tree because of that. And it's all gone a bit quiet. I don't know whether you can comment in on it or not, but I was just curious whether you knew any of the current status of the code.
I was actually at LinuxCon last week, and I was talking with Hank from Microsoft, was presenting on the Hyper-V drivers and the current status, and they're very much working on getting that into the mainline. They're a little bit worried. The question is, nobody's ever actually gotten out of the staging tree into mainline, so there's a lot of mechanism questions. But as most of the kernel developers, we say, send a patch, just make it so, and we'll argue about whether it's ready or not at that point. So I think the next, probably not for this release. I don't know if everybody's familiar with the Linux release model, but basically we have a 2-week merge window, and then we have a settling down period, and actual releases roll out about every 3 months. So I don't really think the Hyper-V drivers will be out of staging for this release, but probably by the end of the year, they'll be there.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of releases, I understand that one of the features in this most recent release is that you've greatly enhanced perhaps the IPv6 support. Am I right on that? Can you describe why IPv6 is important when most of us are really familiar with IPv4?
We live in the nice, happy land of the U.S. where IPv4 addresses have been bought up by people, and most of them are still available. There's a few ISPs that I guess the users may not be familiar with the fact that IPv4 has a 32-bit address space. Mm-hmm. 32 bits is just about enough numbers to count most of the IP users today. I mean, it gets carved up. There's another problem, too, which is it gets carved up in chunks. Mm-hmm. Well, about the end of the year, that space is going to run out. In fact, there's people talking about having auction sites to buy and sell IP addresses. And so the technology has been around to solve that for quite a while using IPv6, where the address gets much, much bigger. It's 128 bits, 16 bytes long. So the software to support that has been worked out over the years. In fact, Linux itself has had it for quite a while. We just got around in the last release, this upcoming release of Viata, of cutting off the last few bits and pieces of services that were missing support for IPv6. So I suspect you'll see a lot more in the future, and all the things you've learned about IPv4 and configuration, you just have to apply them to IPv6 and curse the fact that you can no longer remember the addresses because they're too long.
And type a lot of colons too. I remember that. I'm just starting to wake up to IPv6 as well too. I have tunnelbroker.com offers a free V6 tunnels to whoever asked for it, which is really an amazing service coming out of Hurricane Electric. So I got a V6 tunnel to my house here, and now I have permanent V6 addresses that are internet routable, which is the great thing. And, all the stuff behind all the NAT, now I don't have to worry about NAT because I just, it goes all, now I have to worry about firewalls, which are a lot more interesting. And in fact, I have three different sources. I have a /48, and that's apparently enough to enumerate every grain of sand in the world with my own address or something. Isn't it something in that ballpark?
Yeah, I guess you'll have to give every flea in the house an IP address. But
Yeah, and so Viata is going to be up and fully supporting that. That's a good thing for all this. And so you say that you think V4 will survive another year or so, and then we'll have to just pony up and figure out what V6 is?
Depends what you're doing. I'm sure that the cable companies and everybody has enough addresses stored away to last quite a long while. But if you're deploying a new service, everybody's going to be using IPv6. I'm surprised, actually, that all the mobile phone networks rolled out with IPv4. One would have thought that that's kind of a closed environment, that they would have built it with IPv6. But as you were mentioning with the firewall things, a lot of the backbone infrastructure of companies just isn't set up to handle IPv6.
Yeah, although it's slowly getting there. Apparently, more and more top-level domains are getting V6 addresses and stuff. And so I guess it's definitely something we all ought to be looking at. I could probably do a whole show on this, actually. It's kind of a lot of fun talking about that. But I really don't want to do a show about that. I don't want to do a show about Viata. So let's see. Have we pretty much touched on everything we wanted to talk about today? Did you have any burning topics and suggestions after this?
I really like to hear users with suggestions for enhancements, because we get the commercial suggestions show up all the time, right? The Salesforce shows up and says, oh, we have a deal for this if we just provide this service. Mm-hmm. And it gets prioritized and shows up. The suggestions from users are something that I don't see as often. And I really would like to see more suggestions of what would be cool. And I'd love to hear more stories about how users are using Viata to do cool things.
You might have trouble getting contributions because, I mean, I know that if I'm just one guy, you know, I'm a vocal guy most of the time, so I don't have too much problem with this. But, you know, sometimes I think when I'm downloading something or playing with something that, you know, if I just send a suggestion in, it's just going to go in some bit bucket somewhere. But you're actually saying you're actively soliciting feedback, even for people like me. Like if I download this and said, you know, the command interface is ugly, is there some way you can change this? Yeah. You would actually listen for questions like that.
Yeah, that's really what I always like to hear. Things, whether or not they get acted on, often there's bigger things that are happening that cause whatever the behavior is to exist. But a lot of times, unless somebody makes a suggestion, we don't hear about it. Just like Andrew Morton said about what's the best thing upcoming kernel developer could do, test it on every piece of hardware and report every problem that they see, because mm-hmm. no one else will do it for you.
And so, and how would somebody participate? Do you have forums? Do you have mailing lists, IRC channels, that kind of thing?
We have two forums. One's for user kind of questions, and one's for, we call it Viata Hackers, and that's where the people that want to repurpose or add, extend, or have more technical details show up. Seems the forums, you can also get those forums as mailing lists. I guess I'm too old school. I don't like to log into a forum, so I always pick things up on the mailing list.
Cool.
Yeah, so I suppose to kind of wrap things up a bit, how do you see things going in the future? Have you got any kind of roadmap set out, or you know what's coming up in the future of Viata?
Well, we have no magic bullet, no big thing going. I guess that what I see is that we've covered the 80% of what people need, and the 20% keeps growing and growing. So, more and more features, more and more special cases, and. And the virtualization environment provides some special requirements for people, so I think that we'll be working with a lot of the other upstream projects that deal with how to manage virtual hosts and how to migrate virtual hosts and how to provide better performance. A lot of this virtualization right now is a great way to take what was a very fast standalone thing and turn it into a slow thing again.
I was actually sort of curious about that. So, I mean, why would I have this inside a VMware thing except to test it? I wouldn't really deploy with that, would I?
A lot of customers actually deploy with it. And the reason is because they have people that know networks and they know how to talk the router interface. They do not know how to talk VMware. They do not know how to talk Xen. They don't even know how to talk KVM. So they want something that has those protocols in a way that they're really able to be familiar with. I guess humans change slower than machines, so humans dictate the architecture.
I guess that makes sense. Plus, you also, whatever state that the router might need to have to maintain stateful conversations, if we have VMware failovers and we could just migrate the whole VMware image over. Maybe. I don't know. Higher protocols do that, though. Yeah.
Well, there's also the security thing. People often worry that things like BGP, which is the protocol that they use to talk to other routers. If that was compromised, they don't want to get the whole machine compromised, so they want to isolate it in a VM.
Cool, cool. Okay, I got one very important question to ask last, and that is Emacs or VI?
I'm a Emacs, sorry. I've been around Emacs forever.
Emacs site score, and obviously a Perl user too, so Perl versus Python, it's already redundant, but okay. Well, I appreciate having a hometown boy here on the show again. I'm sorry I didn't realize you were just right from around the corner. I actually think I'm pretty sure we have bumped into like at plug meetings or something. I think I've seen you somewhere around here. You look really familiar. Okay. Or maybe it's just that you look scarily, and the chat room brought this up, you look scarily like Steve Gibson. So I don't know if you're...
Oh, no.
I was going to say that, but I didn't know if it was...
Have to go. Yeah,
well, more so than any other guest we've had. Up,
More so than any other guest we've had. You look a lot like Steve Gibson, who's coming right up next on the live network here. Anyway, I want to thank you, Stephen, and Steve, too, which is... Okay, maybe every Steve looks the same. Maybe that's what it is. But I'd like to thank you, Stephen, for coming on the show today and talking about Viana and letting us know a little bit about your company's products and how people can participate. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed being here. You had good questions.
Very good. Very good. We'll have to meet up for a beer later since we're both physically close by.
Sounds good.
Thanks, sir.
Thanks.
That was Stephen Heminger. He works for the company that supports Viana. I think it's must be Viana.com, I guess. So we're talking about his product. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, it sounds really interesting. I think, you'd expect me to say this as a Linux guy, but I think, this kind of embedded network hardware space is somewhere where Linux is doing really well. And it seems to be there's a lot of work going into the networking components in the kernel and all the rest of it. So it sounds like they're doing some good stuff there.
Yeah, I like the fact that, at least they've thought about the fact that having an open source means that you can have, sort of aftermarket add-ons and things like that, although I appreciate his sentiment that, if that stuff doesn't get back upstream, back to him, and back to Viata, then it's really sort of localized components and stuff. But, that's the nature of open source, too, is that, not only do we get the source of the people that have gone ahead of us, we don't necessarily have to, give it back. It's just the way the licenses work that way.
And I hope that anybody who has used this, maybe who's watching or listening, is Stephen was saying he'd like to get your feedback. So go and tell him what you think of it and what you want to see. And that's another thing that open source is about, being able to talk to the developers.
Well, I also appreciate the fact that they have a really great website. I was actually poking around in there, and it's a little bit awkward for navigation, but they do have a lot of details, especially about like some performance numbers, comparing it to the commercial hardware, and for a fraction of the cost, borne out partially because it's an open source product, you can get a really high performance unit for a lot less than you'd pay for that those big guys' hardware, which is really nice.
Yeah, sounds cool. Excellent.
Cool. So speaking of upcoming guests, it wasn't speaking of upcoming guests until just then, but what about that transition? Hey, how about those apples? Okay. Speaking of upcoming guests, next week we have you again. You're coming back as a host again, two in a row.
I don't know about
that.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be speaking to Dan Scott and Mike Rylander, who are going to talk to us about the Evergreen Library System, which is being used in hundreds of libraries, I'm told, all over the U.S., maybe perhaps around the world. All those fancy software that you need to keep track of who's got what book and where the catalog items are and stuff like that. I haven't researched this yet. I know it's just a library system. Sorry. we'll find out more before next week. Believe me, it always works that way. Following week, I'm really looking forward to Thomas Cherry Holmes is going to come in and talk about the Linux MCE, which is a home automation, home alarm control, home media center, everything in the world sort of thing. And I'm really looking forward to that. We have a guest co-host. We actually have I forgot to bring it up. Darn it. We have Wilkinson, I think it is. So what is Dustin Wilkinson? Scott Wilson. Scott, want to get his right name? Scott Wilkinson, who will also host the home media show or home theater show on the TWiT Network. So that's going to be cool to have him here. We also have future guests with a lot of blanks. I haven't been updating it on my schedule, so I've got to do a lot of booking this weekend for all the September and October slots. So next week I'll have a lot more guests to announce. But if you want to look at the upcoming guests, it's linked to from twit.tv/floss. It gives you all the upcoming potential guests and all the guests as I currently schedule them in. Also watch my tweets to figure out when I get guest scheduled, because I always like to announce that I've done that. You can follow me on Twitter. It's twitter.com/Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. If you follow me on Twitter, you also know that one of the things I like to do is live stream karaoke. I'm doing that tonight if you're watching the live show. I'm going to be at Dragon Con in a couple weeks, hanging out at least a little bit of the time with Tom Merritt and Veronica Belmont, doing some sort of show down there. They don't know that yet, but I'm going to be like stalking them, I guess. I'm also going to be speaking on a few panels at DragonCon, the usual Hacker 101 and Hacker 201, so you'll see me tweeting and maybe streaming from there if I can get enough bandwidth. There's usually really horrible bandwidth from that place. Where can we see you soon, Dan? What's going on with you?
Well, obviously there's Linux Outlaws every Monday night, where we talk about all kinds of open source stuff, including Linux and other things. And then there's Rat Hole Radio, which is a music show that I do, which you can find at ratholeradio.org. And there's a few live events going on in Liverpool, where I'm from, as you may guess from the accent, if you haven't heard me before. There's a few live events going on. There's a lot of hardware hacking stuff going on in Liverpool right now, which is something that I haven't really got into yet, but a lot of Arduino hacking and stuff like that, which I want to get into. So there's some big events going up there.
And I'm sure you'll be discussing on Linux Outlaws, being the new show that you are, the stuff about Oracle versus Google and Oracle versus the Open Solaris and all that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, we talked about that this week. In fact, last night. No, night before. I'm losing track of the days. The night before. Yeah, what day is it? We talked about the whole Oracle bombshell, I suppose you would call it, that exploded last week, yeah.
Great, great. So that's where linuxoutlaws.com.
Linuxoutlaws.com.
And I got to say, people keep writing me saying, why don't you do more news on Floss Weekly? Well, you know, I barely have the time to schedule the guests that we talk to. Doing a news show, as you're about to tell me, Dan, is a lot of work, right?
It is. It's tough. I'm fortunate that I have a studious German to do most of the work for me, and I can just sweep in and pretend that I know what he's talking about.
So I just need to get a studious German then.
You just need to get yourself,
If there are any studious Germans that want to apply, you can email me at merlin@sunhinge.com. You can also suggest guests that way. But again, if you're going to suggest a guest, just have them write me. It's a lot easier that way. I don't have to do this cold sales call, which I don't like doing either. I think that pretty well covers everything I was going to cover today. Any last words, Dan?
No. Take care. Stay free. Stay open source. That's what we always say on the Linux Outlaws. So there you go.
Beautiful. And what I always say here is we'll see you again next week on Floss Weekly.